These are the three things that I think you should know about today. 7, European leaders are irritated that the United States and Russia are talking to each other, and they want it to stop. So they're heading to Washington to try and convince President Trump to ignore President Putin and continue the war in Ukraine. But you know, it's funny, the people of the US and the people of Europe are generally not on their side. So why are they still pushing for more war? I'm gonna give you that question. And this is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to begin tonight with the story of 7 dwarfs. No, not those 7 dwarfs. I mean another 7 dwarfs, as they're being described, by the way, by the global press. And yes, it is off to work they go. Off to work to try and convince Washington to continue the war in Ukraine at all cost. Here, let me introduce you to them. Of course, the first one is named Stub. Stub. 7 dwarfs, get it? I'm not even making that up. That's his name. He is the president of Finland, and his actual name is Alexander Stubb, followed by Ursula von der Leyen, the unelected leader of the EU. And then there's the UK's Keir Starmer, Germany's Fred Merz, Italy's Giorgia Meloni, France's little man, Emmanuel Macron, and coming in at number 7 is another guy that nobody elected, Mark Rutte, the head of NATO. There they are. So why are these 7 Europeans that I just showed you on the screen being generally characterized globally by a lot of media as weak and diminutive these days? Well, it's pretty simple. See, their countries used to rule the world, but today they barely rule themselves. They are, by most measures, considered weak, small, and hurting. Yeah, their economies especially. Even just a cursory look reveals that these 7 leaders should probably be thinking about spending more time trying to make life better for their own citizens than worrying about Ukraine. Their countries suffer from high crime, high inflation, high taxes, high immigration, and wages that are going down, down, down every single year. And their people are complaining about this. So what is their priority? What are they doing? What are they spending most time on? Volodymyr Zelensky. That's right. They're going to Washington to defend a man in a sweatshirt that Ukrainians, his own people, are in the streets protesting against because they say they want his war and his corruption to stop. That's what the people of Ukraine say. And you know what's even worse? He's not elected. He's not elected. That's right. When Mr. Zelensky's term expired, he canceled the next election. I wonder why. I wonder if it's maybe because polls show he likely would have lost. See, that alone seems hypocritical as hell to me, right? Seems hypocritical for Europe, these Europeans, these so-called purveyors of democracy, these 7 people, to do that. In other words, is it democratic to back a leader who was not democratically elected and go around the world saying, oh, we're the best democracies and you need to think and be like us? Does that make sense? Because it doesn't make any sense to me. But there's something else. There's something else that these leaders share, by the way, with Mr. Zelensky, which is also why they're being referred to as 7 dwarfs. You see, they too are not the real choice of their own people, it seems, these days, you know? So what I did is I wanted this morning to take a look and see how they were doing in their own countries. So I Googled it, right? I went to the Googles and I looked at their polls to see how they're viewed by their own people in their own countries. Let's begin with Giorgia Meloni of Italy. Only 42% of Italians approve of her job performance. 42%. By the way, that's the best. That's the most impressive number among the worst. Because here's the next guy, Fred Merz, German chancellor. He's at 35%. And he's heading in the wrong direction because I checked. 2 months ago, he was at 38%. Now he's at 35%. Those are his people. And then there's Starmer, right? In the UK, 23% approve of him. Look at that. Can you imagine? 23%? That means what? Like 67% of his own people don't like this guy and have an unfavorable view of him? I mean, even Joe Biden has better numbers. And then there's the husband of Brigitte Macron, France's president, is approved of by only 29% of the French people. I mean, that means what? 70% of his countrymen also don't like him and don't think much of his performance? Those are crazy numbers. I mean, they really are. And by the way, who's the guy who's pushing the most to continue the war in Ukraine indefinitely? If you guessed Mr. 29 himself, Mr. Macron, then you'd be right. And here's what Mr. Macron says that he will say when he talks to Mr. Trump.
Et donc, si on veut... If we want this peace to last, there must be a solid and robust Ukrainian army. We need a credible format for the Ukrainian army. That's the first point. And we Europeans and Americans need to say how we'll train them, equip them, and finance this effort in the long term. It's legitimate, the best defense and the outpost of our collective defense if Russia wanted to advance again.
So more war, more war, more war, more weapons, more weapons, more weapons. Let's keep this thing going. It's basically what that translates to. But not all European leaders agree with Macron and his pro-war group. In fact, Hungary's Viktor Orban says these countries, these seven dwarf countries, right? They're basically, according to him, dying off. They're on a death spiral.
How many years do you give the EU in its current structure to still work?
Few. So we are in the last phase now. So, okay. The European Union, for many reasons, finally lost its competitiveness.
Finally lost its competitiveness, and he's giving them maybe a few years, and then they're going to be nothing. They're not going to matter. I don't know what he means. Maybe they're not going to exist. Who knows? It's a hell of a thing for a European to say about other Europeans, no? Orban's statement that those countries maybe have just a few years left before they are rendered irrelevant by the real powers out there these days, like China and India, makes you wonder, doesn't it? Here's what I was thinking when I was listening to Orban say that. Do you think these countries are really fighting for Ukraine? Do you think Macron really cares about Ukraine? Or do these countries and people like Macron, are they really trying to preserve themselves? Are they really just trying to preserve their own power? And to remain in power, what do they deploy? The resources of billionaires and the media who are paid off continually to lie about things that simply aren't true. You've heard these things. Zelensky, he's Mother Teresa. Putin, always the bad guy. Ukraine, they're winning the war. Russia's military, it's being destroyed. Now, you know, those are all lies. They're all lies and damn lies, as they say. But let's suppose you're just some guy who worked all day. He gets home, he's tired, he's in Liverpool, right? You're living in Liverpool. And you get home and you turn on the telly, as they say there. And what do you see? Those lies. And you hear them over and over and over again. See, the truth these days is not found when you turn on the telly to watch the news on like the BBC. It's found in alternative media. And I'll give you an example of something I just found on alternative media, and I'm glad I found it. You got to see this. You're going to love this. You're going to cheer, because I did, when I was watching this on my own TV. This is Colonel Doug McGregor, and he's getting angry about the constant lying that is going on. So watch his reaction here to this host's mainstream media description of the war in Ukraine?
So maybe let's just give our audience a bit of an overview of how you see the what's happening on the battlefront. We're seeing advancements on the Russian side, especially in the recent weeks, but they've been relatively minimal. There is, one could say, a stalemate there. Both sides are losing a lot of men, a lot of equipment.
That's nonsense, Mario. Stop wasting my time. Stop lying to your audience. That's bullshit, okay? The Russian losses have dropped to single digits. Think about that. 60, 90 days ago, they were double digits. Ukrainian losses are continuously horrific. So this is a nonsense that people are repeating on their way into this discussion with the Russians up in Alaska. You have no chance of coming to any sort of reasonable outcome when you have distortions on the strategic level of the kind that you've just outlined. That's absolutely false, completely wrong. Now, you're free to believe it, but I'm not going to sit here and listen to that nonsense because it's just not true.
Because it's not, it's just not true. I love that guy. I mean, we need more of that. Damn it, we need more truth telling. He's right. It's not true. It's not true. But whether you or I or Doug McGregor, a rightly honest military commander, by the way, likes those lies or not, those lies are what is powering the war in Ukraine. Those lies are powering the war in Ukraine. They are what many Americans believe. I know. They are what weapons manufacturers want President Trump to believe. They are what neocons like Lady Lindsey Graham wants the president to hear. And they're also the lies that Europe's seven dwarfs, as they're being called, will faithfully deliver to President Trump. So the question is, and this is really what it's all about, will the president, hear me out here, will President Trump buy those lies, or will he call them out? Will he say, no, that's not true? You know, it's hard to tell. It's hard to read Trump. I don't know. But we did kind of get a hint of his ambivalence at the end of the news conference with Mr. Putin. I don't know if you saw this, but when I saw this, I went like, oh, I grimaced. Especially, I'm an American. So it kind of made me uncomfortable to see this. Made me uncomfortable to see it because it told me things I didn't want to believe, right? I'm gonna play it for you. You watch it. Here's this moment at the end when Mr. Putin looks at Mr. Trump and invites him to go to Moscow. And Mr. Trump could not accept that simple request. Watch it.
Mr. President, I'd like to thank you very much. And we'll speak to you very soon and probably see you again very soon. Thank you very much, Vladimir.
Next time in Moscow.
Oh, that's an interesting one. I don't know. I'll get a little heat on that one, but I could see it possibly happening.
Mr. Putin asked Mr. Trump if he wanted to go to Moscow for the next meeting, and you would think that Mr. Putin had thrown a bomb at him or something. Like, what? Why was that reaction like that? Did you see that? I mean, what does that tell you? When the president of the United States of America reacts that way, like he's a little kid in school, who thinks he might get in trouble with the principal for saying yes. Who's he worried about? That's going to give him the heat, as he said. Oh, I'm going to get in too much heat. I mean, I got to tell you, man, I found that moment extremely revealing because it says everything about how powerless the American presidency really is. Think about it. That's the president of the United States. And he seems to be suggesting that now he has to go convince somebody else to let him, to give him permission. He has to go talk to somebody to give him permission to go talk to Vladimir Putin in Moscow. Like, permission to go talk to another world leader who happens to be the president of a nuclear superpower. I mean, how important is that moment? Well, tell you what, I'm going to ask somebody who perhaps knows as much about reading people, about negotiations, as anyone we could find. He is Professor Maxim Suchkov. He is the director of the Institute of International Studies at the top university in Moscow. In fact, he's considered so good at what he does, he actually is the guy who they call on to train many of the country's top negotiators there. And he's here. In fact, we invite him now to walk into the studio because he is going to be joining us to have this conversation. And I think it's an important conversation. You know what it is? In many ways, it's the very thing that there's not enough of right now as we watch this situation unfold in Alaska. But he's here, and we're going to have a conversation about this. Professor, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
I'm so glad that you're here. What did you make of that moment? I almost fell off my chair when I was watching the news conference, and I saw my president, the president of the United States, almost freak out when Mr. Putin invited him to go to Moscow, like he was afraid of the question and afraid that he could be in trouble or get in trouble for answering that question. What did that say to you?
Well, we remember how this attempt to work something out between Moscow and Washington worked out back in the day during their Helsinki meeting back in, you know, when Trump
was the first president. You're right. You're right. I'm thinking of that now. Continue. You're right. I hadn't thought of that.
And I'm pretty sure the moments, you know, when he was, where was it, Trump was interpreted as being too nice and too loyal to Putin, and these moments still haunt him. You know, he doesn't want to be seen.
And let me remind the media in case they don't remember, because I hadn't thought of that. I'm so glad you reminded me of that. He goes to Helsinki, he sits down with Putin, and for a month straight, he's ridiculed in the media. He's called a Putin apologist, a Putin puppet, a Putin this, a Putin that. And he was beaten up, not just by the media, but especially by the neocons and the others in the military community. Continue.
Sure. So this time around, I think Trump is put all his precautions in the right places, and the meeting went really well, even though we saw how different mainstream Western media tried to torpedo the meeting before it took place, and then they tried to mock it and say, well, Trump totally lost it to Putin, and Putin emerged as a sole winner, where, in fact, was, in my view, a win-win situation for the world and for peace, first and foremost. Now we see the group of European leaders and the Ukrainian, expired leader, as they call him in the Russian media, because his term is expired officially. Nobody really voted for him.
One of the cool things about you, and one of the cool and why I'm so glad you're here, I am so grateful that you're here and you are going to help us understand this. You literally are a professor of this very thing. You've trained some of the best negotiators in Russia on how to have conversations with the West. And it seems to me, by the way, and I wanted to say this to you, it seems to me, since I've been here in Russia, that this is something Russia takes very seriously. It seems like negotiators, people like you in this country, they take the profession seriously, they take facts seriously, they take their history seriously, and instead, the West sends over people like Steve Witkoff, who I'm sure is a wonderful man, a smart man, a wealthy man, but he's a real estate investor. He's not a trained geopolitical negotiator. Does that bother you a little bit? What do you make of that?
Well, I think Witkoff is a reflection of how diplomacy is made these days, or perhaps should be made, in the sense that, of course, he's not an elected official, but he has personal trust from the president, and he does his shuttle diplomacy in time of Twitter. You know, you go there and people already know that you're there and what you're talking about. In some sense, I think Henry Kissinger would not be as successful today. Hmm. Because, you know, by the time he left Cairo for Jerusalem, people would already be tweeting everything he said in Cairo and stuff. So in that sense, I think he's doing the right job, even though, of course, it's kind of a departure from the classic diplomacy. He's paired on the Russian side with another guy who knows American deal-making quite well, Kirill Dmitriev, who enjoys personal trust from the president. So I think at that level, they're still paired. But again, this is, again, some type of interaction where now...
Do you have confidence that they're going to be able to come up with some kind of workable deal? And let me ask that in two parts, because there's really two parts to this. And this is really important for our audience to understand. And I think our audience, we've got millions of people watching us right now from all over the world, and I think they generally get it. But there's really two discussions here. One of them is about ending the war in Ukraine. And the other one is about perhaps an even more important question, and that is creating better relations between the United States and Russia. So those are two separate questions. And I think for Mr. Putin, I can't give you one without the other. Mm-hmm. Is that, am I correct?
I think you're correct, but I think it's also Trump's approach in the sense that they do not and cannot compartmentalize these two baskets, right? They have to come together. There is a fine difference between the two, I think, is in the sense that Trump thinks it's a prerequisite, you know, settling Ukraine is a prerequisite for unlocking some of the areas for cooperation between the United States and Russia, where Putin thinks we can go in two parallel tracks and compartmentalize these two areas. As a Russian, perhaps I should be pessimistic, given our geopolitics and history. Russians tend to be more pessimistic than Americans.
Well, but today... hold on. I'm going to interrupt you there, and I'm going to help you actually.
Sure.
Russians should be pessimistic.
Yes.
Do you know how many times you've been lied to? You know how many times you've been cheated? You know how many times you've been told one thing and then actually the West did completely the opposite? You would be an idiot to go into these negotiations expecting to just believe whatever
sure.
they tell you.
Well, that's what I say.
I don't mean to call you an idiot.
I was going to say that I should be pessimistic, but I think now there might be a good time or at least a window of opportunity to explore that. Now we're going to see the team of negotiators coming from Europe to Washington today, who probably were most likely to try to Bidenize Trump, kind of do a rematch mm-hmm. of whatever he negotiated with Putin and put him back on the trajectory the Biden administration pursued by sending more arms and saying that Russia is a threat to the United States and they cannot, throw European allies under the Russian bus and all that stuff. But I think...
Doesn't that seem crazy to you?
It does seem crazy, but...
Is there anywhere in your wildest imagination where you see a world where as soon as this war ends, Russia starts invading Poland?
Well, I think there is... totally not. But I think also there is a mismatch between their own narratives, where on the one hand, they're pouring millions of dollars into building military infrastructure, thinking that Russia is going to occupy all Europe. On the other hand, they're saying Russia is weak and decreasing, and they can't really take Ukraine, and
God,
their
economy
is
right.
plummeting.
You're right. But I hadn't thought about
that. There's no connect between these two
You
narratives.
Can't say both things can't be true. Russia can't be so incredibly weak, and as Mr. Zelensky said, I think, 3 days ago, the sanctions are working and the economy is in shambles and the people are suffering and et cetera, et cetera. You can't say that and then in the next breath say it is such a powerful country, it's about to take over Europe.
Well, this is the disconnect they created themselves to simply prop up their own political future. And that's why they're clinging to these narratives so strongly now, because if there is common sense or revolution of common sense in Strupp, as Trump called it during his inauguration, talking about American politics.
Yeah.
I think there's also should be a revolution of common sense in the global politics, and it should start with Ukraine.
It must be really hard for somebody like you, because, I mean, you're the smartest of the smartest, right? I mean, and you look at this analytically, and you know what the answers are. And when you watch these programs and you hear these people say these idiotic things, I mean, you just... You blow your stack, as we say in America. What would you do? What can we do? What can be done to try and help the rest of the world, and especially the Western world, understand that those things are all lies that are being told to them?
Look, I learned as an undergrad, I attended a college in the U.S., and the first thing they taught me there was the critical thinking skills. So I think the basic thing is just everyone should resume their basic critical thinking skills. And second, I use a verse from the Bible where Jesus said you should judge when you're trying to, find the Antichrist by their deeds. Just look on the merits. The propaganda is coming everywhere from every single corner. You should just, use your critical thinking skills and judge for yourself.
So let's role play, okay? I'm Donald Trump, and you're the Russian negotiator. And God bless me, I'm a good guy. I mean well, and I deep down would like to see better relations with Russia, but I really think that you guys are just killing a bunch of people, mm-hmm. and you're killing civilians, and your country's in trouble, and you want to take over, and we need to stay at war with you because that's what my generals told me, because it's important to keep you in check and keep you weak. So those are the things that I believe, even though none of them are true, and somehow you have to not insult me because I'm dumb and make me feel like you have to move me in a different direction to help me understand the truth. What would you say to me?
Well, this is a kind of an elevator.
I'm Donald Trump, but, this is but my elevator. Skin doesn't look orange.
This is an elevator pitch, right? You got like 10 seconds to shift someone's opinion on things, which is difficult, of course. I'll ask if you're Donald Trump, what's in that war for you? Because I can name a
say that again.
Of
what's in it for you?
What's in the war for you?
Got
if
it.
You continue fueling that, how much of any items on the agenda that you promised to the American voter can you achieve, right? Because I can think of a number of things that you can achieve through renewed partnership with Russia. Obviously, throughout 30-plus years, U.S.-Russia were, like, up and down all the time, and this is, I guess, I don't know, fifth or sixth attempt at a reset. But this time, I think, may be different because the agenda that Trump is trying to promote within the United States is somewhat different. And I think this is the first time since the end of 1980s where the so-called collective West is not so collective, because there is some ideas that Trump is trying to promote. There is a strategic vision, whereas there is no strategic vision among the European leaders, at least the ones you talked about. And I guess this is the first time since 1940s where Russia and the U.S. actually have much more in common than Russia and Europe.
You know, it's almost like I like where you're going with this. You need to make me know why I need to do this. And to be honest with you, he does need to do this right now. I mean, he's getting his butt kicked with Gaza. He's getting his butt kicked with Epstein. He just got his butt kicked by Brazil and India, telling him, you don't tell us what to do and we'll do whatever business we want to do with Russia. If he's smart, he knows that the global South community is growing really big and the Western countries, including the U.S., are not. So given all those things, God, wouldn't it be smart with him to do a deal with Russia for so many reasons? If nothing else, to have a win, because he needs a win. And number two, if he does a deal with Russia, he can kind of pull them away from the China's embrace and kind of hurt the global South's BRICS, whatever the heck you want to call it, power structure that is being created.
Well, I think that's probably where his instincts are leading him to. Even though if you're sitting in Moscow, that it's
right.
A little difficult. It's more complicated. Russia is with China not just because the Americans pushed Russia in the hands of China, even though that was a big factor. China is a large neighbor. It's a quick developing economy, so deals with China are necessary, and will continue. The scale perhaps may be negotiated, but that's an important. And the growing global South is also an important part of the Russian foreign policy calculus. It's not either or. But like I said, I think...
Well, I understand.
Sure.
And I'm not saying he's going to be able to talk, you know, Putin into picking up the phone and calling Xi and saying, hey, we're not friends anymore. I'm going to be friends with Donald now instead of you. I don't think that's going to happen. But what I do think can happen is by establishing a relationship with Russia, the United States can have its China moment, its China-Nixon moment. Nixon-Mao moment.
Sure.
You know what I'm
sure.
trying to say. And it can at least cut in a little bit into that structure. Here's the problem with that. You know that. I know that. You're a lot smarter than I am. But most of the idiots who are not even as smart as me in the United States don't know that. Most people don't even know what the Global South is. They don't even know what BRICS is. And Trump is just now being explained these things. So you're trying to sell a Mercedes to a guy who's driving a tricycle.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, you know, once I heard this saying where they say, well, you take Trump literally but not seriously, whereas it should be the other way around. You should take him seriously but not literally. So I think that is exactly the approach Russia is adopting. They're taking his instincts and his vision seriously.
Yeah.
And they're trying to explain where exactly the deal in Ukraine can unlock some of the areas for cooperation between the U.S. and Russia and how that can help his America First policy, but which also in some way would be Russia First policy if you're talking about energy deals, if you're talking about lifting some of the sanctions, you're talking about the Arctic's Middle East agenda, you just mentioned Gaza, many other things. It's just that, you know, the U.S. and Russia have enjoyed so much power in the world, but they have been at loggerheads with one another, and a lot of these areas for cooperation have been locked for so many years, which I think is just silly.
What are the chances, you think, that Trump will look at these European leaders and say to them, what I just said a little while ago to my viewers, when I said, and what Orban said, you know, these are countries that used to rule the world, and today they barely rule themselves. They're not that powerful anymore. Their economies are a joke. Their countries are in disarray. Their people are angry. Their wages are going down. Inflation is going up. They can't control crime. They can't control immigration. They can't control inflation. They got big problems. So what the hell are they doing trying to prop up Ukraine? Why don't they prop up their own countries, right? Do you think Trump gets that? Do you think he can look at these people and say, hey, guys, look, first of all, I'm so glad you're here. Thank you for coming. But let's talk about something really important here. You guys are not what you used to be. That's hard, isn't it?
Well, I guess it was exactly the message that Vice President J.D. Vance tried to convey during his Munich Security Conference speech.
You're right.
Right, that's exactly what he said. And I heard he's going to be around during today's meeting in the White House. Maybe he's there for a reason, to just remind them in case they're trying to punch above their weight where exactly they belong. But I have to say, as we train some of the Russian negotiators and future policymakers, the one thing you have to remember, you never underestimate your opponent. So even if these countries performing poorly, and especially their leaders are totally bankrupt, they still carry a lot of capacity to do some nasty things, which they have done over the past 3 to 4 years. Hmm. So you have to approach them carefully because they do have some cards to play in their pocket.
That's smart. You're such a smart guy. No wonder you teach these guys. Yeah. See, my instinct, maybe because I'm Cuban, my instinct would be to go in there and start telling him, you guys are idiots. Look at the stupid things you've said and look what you've done. And maybe that's a little Trump coming out of me, but you're absolutely right. The smart thing to do is never underestimate your opponent. Give him whatever credit they may be due and move from there. Which reminds me, and that brings us to maybe one of the most important discussions that you and I are about to have. And that is the Zelensky factor. So I'm hearing different versions. I don't know what you've heard. You may be more read up than I have. Last time I checked, they weren't sure whether they were going to meet first with the president, and then afterward, Mr. Trump was going to meet with Mr. Zelensky. So they're going to separate the meetings. Mm-hmm. How important is that? What do you think of that?
Well, I think it's important, but I think Zelensky is now coached by Starmer and Macron and Merz, and everyone is trying to make sure that he, you know, does not...
Think he's going to wear a suit?
I'm sure... I would say he's going to wear a suit, and he's probably going to poke some joke trying to kind of, you know, play back the moment when he was humiliated by not doing that.
Yeah.
That would be... He's a comedian, after all, you know. So he should...
It was a pretty weird moment.
He should probably do that. But I think the reason that the Europeans worried and they're trying to coach him so much before meeting with Trump is they have a lot more at stake, and he's totally independent in whatever he's going to say or do. You know, he still wants to
stay in power. So he's a puppet. You're saying he's a puppet.
I think he's a puppet. He still wants to stay in power. But the big geopolitical stakes are not his own to carry in a way. You know, I think Britain has a lot more to carry.
So let's go through this. All right, so these seven distinguished leaders, wink, are going to walk in and sit with Mr. President, with the American president, and my friend Marco Rubio, and you know,
J.D. Vance,
J.D. Vance, and maybe the two envoys, Kellogg, perhaps, I don't know.
Probably
Witkoff. We'll see. And so, whoever it is, their job will be to try and convince the president of the United States to stay the course, keep giving arms to Ukraine, don't kowtow to Putin, and don't come up with an agreement with Putin that ends the war. That's basically what they're going to try and convince him of, right?
Well, I'm sure, yes. But if you're Trump, your question should be, how is that a win for the United States? Where does exactly America win in that scheme? Right? As if we're... I heard a lot of the argument that, you know, Trump cares a lot about his military-industrial complex, which I'm sure he does.
He does.
And this military-industrial complex of the United States will be rich with different contracts for Europeans in any case, whether there is a deal or there is no deal. Because if Europeans thinking about building their own army and strengthening their own armed forces, they can't produce themselves. They will buy from the United States. But is this the only perk you get? And on the other hand, you get tensions with Russia and escalation and risks of future, you know, nuclear standoff and all kinds of things. You're pretty much writing off your meeting with Putin in Alaska, which I think he's not willing to do.
You think you're a man who knows how to read other people. That's what you do. That's what you train people to do. That's one of the most important part of any negotiation. I'm a businessman. I spent a lot of my life building companies that I took public, or I didn't, with my partners. And one of the things I always thought was the most important thing that a successful leader can have is the ability to sit there across the table from another human being and read them and understand where they're going before they get there. I've been pretty good at that in my life. Sometimes not so good. Sometimes I've been completely wrong. When you read Trump, do you read him as a transactional person, as someone who is completely based on doing a business deal? And if that's the case, which I kind of think it is, he looks at everything like it's a business deal. What is the favorable business deal of redeploying great relations with Russia? What does that business deal look like for you?
Well, that's an interesting one. First and foremost, I think, of course, there should be some settlement on Ukraine. Maybe not resolution, because these are the two different outcomes of conflict dynamics. Resolution, perhaps, is more difficult, even though I think they came closer to that in Alaska than before. Settlement is more likely, but it's not just a mere armistice, which the Europeans were pushing for some time. Then you're trying to unlock some of the areas of cooperation, like they discussed, you know, the Arctic, some of the trade, and some of the other things. As a businessman, Trump does not like free riders. And the Europeans probably know that, so they will most probably be pushing and saying, well, we're going to pay you for your arms, and we're going to take the burden of, you know, restoring Ukraine.
By the way, the United States doesn't have enough arms to sell.
Sure.
Without, you know, endangering their own supplies.
Absolutely.
So what he's going to sell to the Europeans is maybe some stuff that's left over, but that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me.
Right.
But knowing Trump, easy money. Yeah. Okay, you want it? You know, I got an old Mercedes that I haven't even fixed. I'm not sure it runs, but you want to give me top dollar for it? Take it,
sure.
Right?
So on the one hand, you do have some of the kind of what you call transactional, right? He's thinking about the moment. And of course, any American president operates in three domains: as a politician, as a bureaucrat, and as a commander-in-chief. As a politician, he should care about the future of his party and whoever takes power from him in 2028. So he does have to care about the ratings and all these things about the election cycles. As a bureaucrat, he has to manage all kinds of bureaucratic issues, but as a commander-in-chief, his primary goal is to defend the United States, right? So if whatever Europeans and Zelensky are trying to sell on their side should match the these boxes he's thinking about. But most importantly, with him during the second administration, I think it's important that he's also thinking about how to transform the United States into the superpower of the future. You know, talking a lot about cryptocurrencies and technological edge and all these things. And for all of that, you need energy, you need data, you need people, human capital, as they call it today, right? So all of that is achievable, and you can get a lot more of that through deals with Russia than through some conflict on the periphery of American interests.
Yeah, and especially with old Europe in that case.
Sure.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point. That might be the kind of sell that would, that he probably has already thought through. The problem with Trump is his mind can easily be changed as well if you're the last person to talk to him, which is what has me a little bit concerned. Let's talk about Vladimir Putin a little bit. So the stories in the news in the last 24 hours that I've been reading and you've been reading is that he might be softening a little bit, that he might be softening his position. All the headlines I've seen, or not all of them, but some, many of the headlines that I've seen seem to be saying at this point that Vladimir Putin is now willing to walk away as long as he gets the territory that he wants, the four oblasts, obviously. And if he gets the four oblasts and you give him a little bit of sense of security, that he would be willing to maybe do the ceasefire deal. Seems like a much different position than the one that he's been stressing before, which has been, no, firm commitment, no NATO, firm commitment to withdraw all the military out of those four oblasts, respect the position, and then maybe we start talking. So where do you think Mr. Putin is at this point?
Well, the two important things in any negotiations is how to separate people from the problem and how to separate a position from an interest. We should remind our viewers, perhaps, that the conflict in Ukraine did not begin in February 2022. Mm-hmm. It began a lot earlier than that, at least in 2014. Some would say it was a byproduct of U.S., Russia, and Russia, NATO.
2008, right.
Right. Right. So it's not about territory per se, right? The problem is that the conflict, the special military operation began because Russia faced some unfavorable security outcomes in its immediate neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And that was exactly what Putin was trying to solve. And through a demilitarization of Ukraine, denazification, all other things everyone, I think, heard about. So this is the core interest, to produce favorable security outcomes from the crisis that would put Russia in a safer space, right? The defense
Wouldn't,
of the Russian...
But let me just stop you there. Those four oblasts, huge buffer zone between the rest of Ukraine and a corridor that takes you right into Crimea. That's a pretty good win. Couldn't Mr. Putin say, you know what? We did good. We've got all those four oblasts. We've got a corridor that goes into Crimea. We've got a huge buffer. And, you know, if we can just get a security agreement where some kind of mention that they're not going to be joining NATO anytime soon, something like that, then I'll be happy.
Well, the thing is that these territories is a very tricky issue. That's why they bring a lot of military people with them, because for us, it's just some dot on the map. Mm-hmm. And for the military people, it's an important strategic hide. You know, if you don't control that, then Donetsk is under threat and Lugansk, other things. So I can't tell you exactly, you know, how this, whether this is enough or not enough. But I think what they at least been airing in the press that, you know, Russia is talking about or at least what we heard from the Alaska meeting, that, you know, Ukraine should vacate the entire Donetsk Oblast.
And Zaporizhia.
And freeze.
And Lugansk, all of it.
Yes, and then freeze. No, what I heard, the talk was the free vacate Donetsk. And the line in Zaporizhia is frozen where it is now. Ukraine, I think, at least what we hear, wanted some swap. You know, the Russians should live there. But that's I guess for
negotiators. Do you see any way that Mr. Putin or Mr. Lavrov would agree to anything that doesn't give them all or at least a significant part of all four oblasts?
Well, that's difficult to answer because obviously any alternative to a peace deal is continued war. Right. If they don't vacate, then
But they're kicking ass. They're winning the war. So why not continue?
Well, because it's also, you know, blood and treasure spent every day, even if you're winning.
Yeah.
But you can't stop where you are without significant wins that not only secure the present day situation, but also address the future.
Mm.
Because if you just stop where you are, the reason Russia never never wanted just an armistice, it wanted what Putin called an eradication of root causes of the conflict, means you're going to have another conflict in 10 to 15 years where Ukraine becomes what the Europeans call a porcupine, right? They give it more arm, and then it tries to do a rematch and then push for offensive. So that should not be on the table as well. So therefore, the Russians are also thinking about the future, at least in the midterm.
Do you think that there will be much left of Ukraine when this is all said and done? What's your personal opinion looking at that situation? And I say that because I feel terrible for Ukraine. I mean, those are good people, you know, but their country, half their population is living in Poland. They say some of them won't come back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of their money is in London. Their people are on the streets protesting. I'm watching mothers dying on the streets, trying to hang on to what's left of vestiges of their boys and their girls who are being taken off to war. It's kind of a frickin' mess, that country right now.
Well, that, but also if you're a European country or a bunch of European leaders who want to take responsibility for that country, then it means you're going to own that problem and your countries are going to own that problem.
Huh.
Therefore, there are some voices in Russia, even though not mainstream, who say, well, Russia should not be protesting against Ukraine joining EU because it will definitely weaken EU.
Yeah.
And will create more tensions. And if it's more kind of Machiavellian approach to deal, I'm not saying that's an official position of the Russian government.
No, but it's something to think about.
But, but that's there, that people are talking about it. So, but yeah, it's a huge problem, but it's, I guess, the path that their leaders pushed their country to, and Europeans helped a lot.
Final question. Do you think that the Russian military, if there is no deal, will just continue?
I think so.
Going all the way to where? Odessa?
Well, that's a good question. I think that obviously this is the question that Commander-in-Chief should answer. That's the decision for him to take.
You're such a negotiator. You're not willing to give up any points.
Well, you had official negotiators who would probably in this studio who tell you more on that. But,
yeah.
But I think there are different scenarios, of course. Any military people have a bunch of scenarios to play. But I think, unfortunately, the military and the fighting will have to continue. And that's something Putin said. If Ukraine says no, with every new phase of negotiation, the conditions will worsen for it.
Yeah.
And none of the seven leaders who are coming there are going to help.
Right. It gets to a point where you just have to say, let's just stop. But if they won't stop, then you have to keep going, right?
Right. And that's a problem where you're trying to fight the fake reality where you create it and where the reality check on the ground is giving you a different reality.
On a scale of 1 to 10, and 10 being the best, in other words, they have a solution and it's over, 1 being the worst means no deal, this thing's going to continue for another year. Where are you?
I told you I should be a pessimist, but I want to be an optimist today and say it's 6.
6?
Yes. Still to more towards a better.
You're barely the glass is full, but only a little bit over the half-point line, right? It's a delight talking to you. You're wonderful. You're such a smart guy. Thank you for being so nice and coming in here and taking us through this. Wow. I hope so. You know, I can only hope. And, you know, if there is a God, which I think there is, I think he's looking at this situation and trying to help everybody in the world avoid what could become, you know, a nuclear war if these two countries don't come together at some point. And that's even more important than just the situation in Ukraine. At least that's the way I think most thinking, reasonable, rational people see it. Thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it. Remember, my podcast is called Journalistically Speaking. If you get a chance to watch it, we'll probably have some really good cuts of this conversation that you will see on there with my commentary. You could also look for me on X or Twitter or whatever the hell they call it these days, at Rick Sanchez TV. We'll be looking for you next time. We'll see you then.